Washington, 1990s. The rain kept secrets, and a pig farm learned how to eat them. Okay, let's get into this. We're doing a deep dive today into something, well, profoundly unsettling. It's a case study, really. It reveals a lot about systemic failure, about how things can just slip through the cracks. Our mission, essentially, is to analyze what's known in folklore and investigative circles as the Rusty Hog legend. It's a story that shows how, you know, geographic isolation combined with this deep social indifference, how that allows horror to unfold in plain sight for years.
And we're not just looking at it like a standard true crime case. Mm-hmm. The sources, they treat it differently. It's more a study in, let's say, legend versus record. It really highlights how the cold facts maybe weren't as powerful as the psychological impact on the community, the folklore that just grew around this figure at Central.
That blurring, between truth and what people told themselves, that's what gave the perpetrator Rusty Hog his confidence, maybe?
It allowed him to operate, absolutely.
Okay. Because the core question, the one you, the listener, really have to sit with is this. How does an entire community, a whole county, learn to just shrug off a list of missing names, a list that's growing, without demanding answers? How does that silence get so normal?
Well, it's learned indifference, isn't it? It becomes a kind of self-imposed blindness. It probably starts as a way to cope, you know, avoiding difficult truths.
Yeah.
But then it becomes the perpetrator's biggest ally.
The community effectively outsources its responsibility.
Exactly. And he stepped right into that void, took advantage of it.
Okay, let's paint the picture. The setting. 1990s Washington. It's crucial. We're outside a small town, rainy, constantly. And this isn't some quaint little farm. It's a sprawling industrial pig farm. Think mud, corrugated metal.
Damp. Everything damp.
Yeah, low visibility. That constant drizzle just hanging in the air.
And that environment.
Yeah.
It's more than just a backdrop, isn't it? It almost functions like a character in the story.
Yeah.
The rain on the metal roofs, the mud.
Yeah.
It sort of naturally suppresses curiosity. It washes things away, maybe dilutes evidence.
Literally and figuratively.
Right. It's the perfect setting for a crime of omission.
Yeah.
Where anything odd can be explained away by, you know, the grim necessities of running a big, messy farm.
The noise of the place.
A perfect sonic alibi, yeah.
And right in the middle of this scene, Rusty Hog, the sources, they're quite specific about him, almost making him legendary. That constant grin, people mention that a lot. The dirty jacket, oil stains.
That's familiar.
And the thing that really cemented him in the local dive bars, the cash, just endless cash, buying rounds for everyone.
He wasn't seen as a threat. He was a fixture.
Yeah.
Part of the local scene. Predictable.
Weaponized familiarity, you called it.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
He didn't hide in the shadows. He operated in that gray area. Local indifference. His behavior was consistent. The grin, the jacket. It never changed. Made him mundane.
And we filter out the mundane.
He used that filter as camouflage. Definitely.
So let's talk about his strategy. Who he targeted. The sources are very clear. Women on the margins. Living on the highway margins, as one source puts it. Transient core. And his justification. It's reported he had this quote. Chilling.
It's infamous. Not because it explains why he did it, maybe, but because it says so much about how he saw societal value. Or the lack of it. He apparently said they were the kind nobody would miss.
Wow. That's not just a statement of fact from his perspective. It's recognizing the loophole, isn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And this is where we see that systemic vulnerability, right? This group.
Mm-hmm.
They were targeted because he understood the system already minimized them socially, legally.
Mm-hmm.
Law enforcement frameworks. That label, the kind nobody would miss. It wasn't just his view. He was relying on existing indifference.
Banking on the system failing them before he even got involved.
Precisely.
So how did that failure work mechanically? Was it just underfunding or something else?
It was largely bureaucratic, I think, back in the 90s. Missing persons reporting, especially across jurisdictions for people without stable addresses. It was patchy. The effort needed often outweighed the perceived priority. These cases didn't fit the typical task force molds. You know, they didn't grab headlines like child abductions or suburban murders.
So he saw they existed in this investigative gray zone.
Absolutely. Which brings us to that first wrong detail. The thing that let it all keep going. The farm just hummed along. Kept running for years. The smells, the activity, the cash, all normalized.
Nobody asked the hard questions. The farm itself was the explanation.
Right. And at the same time, you have the police playing this, well, unintentional role.
By labeling the missing women as runaways. Or saying they'd moved on to a better life.
Yes. That official classification. It became a shield for him. It's a kind of bureaucratic convenience, isn't it?
A self-fulfilling prophecy of inaction.
Exactly. If they're runaways, they're not victims. If they moved on, the local police aren't responsible anymore. Case closed. Before it really even opened.
So he wasn't just relying on neighbors looking the other way. He was relying on the official structure prioritizing paperwork.
Paperwork and perceived social stability over the reality on the margins. It's a powerful tool for a predator. A closed file needs zero resources, draws no heat. An active case for someone with connections. That draws resources immediately. He knew which category his victims fell into.
And he leveraged that for years.
Yeah.
Which leads us into those years of blindness, this long period where surely there were whispers, contradictions, but the official story, runaway, it just stuck.
The societal shrug.
Yeah.
And we need to think about that reaction. Mm. The sources say neighbors just shrugged, went on with life. It's probably not active malice, more like functional cognitive dissonance.
Mm-hmm.
It's just easier psychologically, socially, to assume someone transient left willingly.
Than to face the horror next door, perpetrated by the guy buying drinks.
Right. The psychological utility of disbelief. The truth was there, missing people, odd character, loads of cash. But the story about transients moving on, safer, required nothing.
The imagery you mentioned, rain on the metal roofs.
Yeah, reflecting the neon signs from the dive bars, in the puddles. The neon promises something bright, temporary escape maybe. But the reflection, distorted, muddy.
The community chose the reflection.
They chose the reflection over the mud underneath, that acceptance, that passive ignorance. It was his protection. Their silence was his shield.
Let's drill down on that runaway protocol again. How exactly did that label just cut off investigation?
Well, that classification, especially then, it acted like an immediate damper. It just dulled the alarms across the system.
Yeah.
To get a full homicide investigation going, you need credible evidence of foul play, right? Involuntary absence. If the official record says voluntary departure, resources get restricted. Phone taps, forensics, interstate alerts.
Yeah.
They're harder to justify, maybe deny it altogether.
So it wasn't just a list of names. It was a filing cabinet full of cases basically defined out of existence as crimes anyway.
Precisely. And you see the link. The community ignoring transients reinforces the classification. Police see no pressure to change it. Hogg saw this. He operated with confidence based on years of predictable institutional indifference to these women. It wasn't just one person failing. It was the system.
Was it willful complicity, though, or just apathy, social fatigue in a tough area?
I think it leans more towards apathy. Born from fatigue, convenience, willful complicity means knowing participation. Apathy is more, choosing not to know. Locals were likely exhausted, economic pressure, social issues linked to transient populations. It's hard to maintain moral vigilance against that backdrop.
These women didn't fit the definition of ours.
That distinction seems key. Ours versus not ours. It allows horror to persist under a guise of normalcy.
And speaking of normalcy, this case, it really lends itself to that darkly poetic framing, doesn't it? The setting, the silence.
Absolutely. It's a study in hidden horror, precisely because the story relies on the unspoken. The silence, even the way sources talk about it, treating the atmosphere, the rain, as analytical points. They recognized its power lies in that contradiction.
The offer of a drink at the bar.
And the grim reality back at the farm.
Yeah.
The silence, the lack of accountability, that's the tension.
The farm was always there, humming, smelling, never questioned, until 2001.
Right. The silence finally broke. But the crucial part, the really sobering part, it wasn't because someone finally connected the dots on the missing women.
It was an accident.
A complete accident. An officer serving an unrelated warrant. After dark. Something administrative.
Nothing to do with the missing persons cases.
Nothing at all.
Yeah.
Which just underscores the institutional failure, the passive role authorities played until sheer chance intervened.
The law shows up for what? An unpaid fine? A property dispute? While this tragedy unfolds for years, the irony.
It's dark. And that unrelated visit after dark. It leads the officer to the evidence. Undeniable. Physical. This is where the mundane crashes into the monstrous.
Tell us about the evidence. A freezer full of personal effects.
Yeah. Just pause on that image. A freezer for preservation. Burvest. Inside. Purses. IDs. Clothes. The things that define a person. Their name. Their identity. Collected. Cataloged.
A shocking roster. And the sources mention this detail. The IDs fanned out like bad cards.
That imagery, It's brutal. It speaks to a cold calculation, doesn't it? A meticulous accounting.
Trophies.
Almost like trophies, yeah. A physical list of lives claimed and officially erased. This discovery, it instantly shattered the runaway narrative. You can't argue someone left willingly when their wallet, their ID, is in a freezer on the property.
The freezer gave the identities the next discovery, the means, the industrial meat grinder.
Yes, and the sight of that. Apparently, it was horrific. This is where the investigation details blend into that chilling folklore. The description that persists. It's deliberately non-graphic, but deeply unsettling.
What was it?
The reports say it was caked with a dark, dried residue. Not from any animal he could name.
Not from any animal he could name.
His aren't.
That freezing. It captures that moment of dawning horror for the officer, right? This isn't farm activity.
Exactly. It confirmed the whispers, the suppressed fears, the symbolism of the grinder. It's essential. It's cold, industrial utility applied to human life. Efficient. Designed for processing. It embodies his view of recycling.
Reducing people to resources.
Disposable resources. Waste nothing. The machine is the physical manifestation of that disregard, transforming life into input for a system.
Strips away all humanity, makes it feel efficient, almost corporate in its cruelty.
And the discovery leads straight to the arrest. The scene, it has this dreadful symmetry.
He was found where?
At his favorite bar. Mid-sip, still grinning.
Still grinning, even then.
That persistence, it shows such detachment. No remorse, no fear. Still playing the part of the affable local. He hadn't broken character, just interrupted.
And then the confession, the quote that sums it all up.
His whole philosophy, really. Utilitarian cruelty boiled down. I just recycled. The pigs ate well, wasted nothing.
Let's unpack that. Recycled, framing it entirely in economic terms, agricultural terms.
It bypasses everything moral or legal, doesn't it? Replaces murder, crime, death with this benign industrial term, recycled. It's all about efficiency, wasted nothing. It reveals this extreme lack of empathy where humans are just biological resources. No emotion, just calculation, inputs and outputs.
That's why the quote sticks. It defines his profound moral absence.
Absolutely.
The county's reaction, immediate physical erasure.
The farm was deemed a horror site. First response. Yeah. Bulldoze it, flatten it completely.
You have to picture that. The bulldozer blade scraping, trying to erase the past, sterilize the land.
Yeah, trying to scrape away the memory, the smell, the fear. But you can't bulldoze trauma, can you?
No. And the local impact. Mm-hmm. Immediate, long-lasting. People suddenly couldn't look at bacon the same way. The mundane contaminated.
That's the ripple effect. That forced reckoning. And it led to this coping mechanism. Dark humor.
Jokes about extra protein.
Right. Trying to outsource the memory to laughter. But the sources say the jokes would land and then the room would just go quiet.
That silence after the joke, that's the trauma resurfacing, isn't it?
It's the sound of it being unresolved. The joke gives a moment's relief, maybe, but the shared knowledge, having ignored it, missed it, it prevents any real release. The horror turns the laughter back on them, reminds them.
Okay, let's pull these threads together for the listener, the lessons here. Three critical things allowed this.
Right. First, the bureaucratic silence, that runaway label shutting down investigation, restricting resources.
The second, the environment itself, the rain erasing trails, literally and figuratively, masking things.
And third, the community looking away, trying to outsource bad memories to laughter, but failing to really forget. It was procedural, environmental, and communal failure.
A perfect, tragic storm of oversight. And that final image, the flattened lot, morning fog. Maybe a feed trough filling with clean rainwater.
That image, it's haunting. It's just cleansing, right? Clean water and a clean trough. But it's on land that's still contaminated.
Oh, morally. Psychically.
False baptism.
Exactly. Trying to erase the past just leaves this blank, desolate space that screams what happened there.
So understanding this Rusty Hog legend, it's more than just a gruesome crime story. It's about understanding the blind spots, societal reporting, investigation, especially for vulnerable people.
People whose perceived absence becomes a form of criminal immunity.
It forces you to confront what we choose to ignore, doesn't it? The official record saw runaways, allowed the horror to persist.
Which brings us to a final thought, something for you, the listener, to carry away from this. The rain still falls in every community. What are we dismissing today as just runaways, just transients, just low priority? What potential horrors are we outsourcing to silence right now?
Are we betting on systemic neglect the way Hogg did?
Because that failure, decades ago, it was a failure of attention, moral attention, bureaucratic attention. The rain still falls, the lot still floods, and when the water clears, there's only mud, no story, clean enough to serve.